So imagine you're sitting down to play this really high-stakes game of chess.
Play the game, I'm with you.
But instead of, actually looking at the board and analyzing the pieces to figure out your next move, you just sit there. And you start yelling at your opponent because, I don't know, you think knights shouldn't be allowed to jump over other pieces.
Right. Like you're just entirely focused on how unfair the rules are.
Exactly. And while you're just shouting at the board about how the game, should be played.
Your opponent is quietly moving their pawns forward.
Yep. Taking your pieces and totally winning the match.
Wow. Yeah, that's a perfect analogy for what we're talking about today.
It really is. And that dynamic, shouting at the board while you lose, that is the focal point of our deep dive today. We are breaking down Chapter 11 from Laws of Life, Book 2. Now build the system for your life. That's by Jack Spirko.
And it's such a crucial chapter.
Yeah, the core thesis is literally right in the title, which is what will happen is more powerful than what should. And, I look at this stuff through the lens of a behavioral economics professor. So I spend all my days analyzing how people respond to incentives
Right.
and basically why we so often just refuse to play the board we're given.
And as a life strategist and career coach, I mean, I see this exact chessboard paralysis constantly. I work with so many young adults who feel just incredibly frustrated with the state of the
Oh,
world.
I'm sure it's everywhere.
It really is. And my entire job is basically helping them convert all that frustration into concrete action plans. So our mission for you listening today is pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
It's time to stop arguing with an unfair reality. We're going to decode the incentives driving the systems around you and basically help you identify your next available move.
Because you really have to figure out how to act inside the world as it actually works.
Yeah.
Right? Not how you wish it worked. So the psychological trap at the center of this, it starts with the pattern that we see everywhere online. It's basically this formula of, X is wrong, so instead of X, we should have Y.
Oh, yeah, the classic social media pile-on.
Totally. Someone posts that, everyone piles on, they commiserate, and they start demanding like political activism to change the entire system.
Right, which sounds productive, but it's really not.
No, from a behavioral economic standpoint, complaining is this highly seductive, low-effort cognitive trap.
The cognitive trap.
Yeah, I mean, it gives you this massive dopamine hit of righteous indignation. It
Ugh.
feels like you're taking action, but it actually completely paralyzes you. You're just arguing with a chessboard.
Which brings us to, honestly, the defining struggle for so many of the people I coach, which is housing.
Oh, housing. Yeah.
Yeah, young adults are understandably just furious about housing affordability right now. And to illustrate this trap, the author talks about going online, seeing someone complain about not being able to buy a house, looking at their budget, and then literally sending them links to four or five affordable fixer-uppers in their exact area.
And let me guess, they are thrilled by the help.
Huh, not quite. Almost universally, the response is just visceral anger.
Really? Anger.
Yeah, they complain that, oh, the place needs new carpet, or the paint is ugly, or the cabinets are dated from the 90s.
But I mean, the resistance isn't really about drywall or paint, is it?
Not at all. The block is entirely emotional.
Wow.
These individuals, they don't actually want a workable move right in that moment. What they want is validation that the system is unfair.
Ah, right. Because if they accept the fixer-upper as a valid move.
Then they have to accept that their fantasy of this pristine, move-in-ready first home is dead. They basically have to mourn the idea of what should be.
And part of that fantasy is grounded in what the author calls the boomer myth,
Right.
right?
Oh, yeah. You hear this one constantly.
Right, this idea that baby boomers stole this 1950s utopia
Yeah.
where, a single income bought a nice house, two cars, and supported a whole family of four.
Yeah, it's a nice story, but economically and historically, it's just displaced anger.
Exactly. I mean, the boomers were literally in diapers in the 1950s.
Yeah.
That golden era economy that actually belonged to the silent and GI generations.
Right, the people who survived the Great Depression and fought World War II.
Yes, every single generation complains about the previous one. I mean, there's even a reference in our source material today to the 1988 song, The Living Years, by Mike and the Mechanics.
Oh, right, just to share how cyclical this whole thing is.
Exactly. Gen X complained about the boomers, millennials complained about the boomers, and eventually, I mean, Gen Z is going to be the villain of the story for whoever comes next.
It's inevitable. But the brutal reality here is that knowing the cause of the housing crisis, that won't get you a set of keys today.
No, it won't.
It just doesn't matter why the market is broken if you are the one standing outside in the pouring rain.
So true. Well, look, if the housing market won't hand you keys, let's look at a system that actively hands you anchors, okay? The student debt crisis.
Oh, boy, yeah, a massive one.
Right. And I want to say up front, this is a deeply polarized, undeniably unfair system. And I want to strictly and impartially report how the author breaks down the political divide here.
Right, without endorsing either side.
Exactly, because honestly, both extremes are offering illusions.
Right.
So on the left, the proposed solution is forgiveness. But functionally, that just forces taxpayers to pay the banks.
Right. And then on the right?
On the right, the answer is essentially, you know, you borrowed it, pay it back.
Right.
Which completely ignores the reality that these kids were 17 years old. They were relentlessly marketed to by teachers, parents, society.
Right. They were basically told they'd be flipping burgers for the rest of their lives without a degree.
Exactly. So neither side actually offers a functioning path forward. And to prove how performative this all is, the author outlines this theoretical 5-page bill that could literally solve the crisis tomorrow.
Wait, 5 pages? How would that even work?
Okay, so the government simply takes over all the loans at 0% interest.
Okay.
Then they cap annual loan amounts, so colleges can't just keep hiking up tuition forever. The student has to maintain a C average. And finally, the loan is linked directly to their social security number for an automatic 5% paycheck deduction until it hits zero.
Wow. So no interest compounding and no way of falling behind.
Right. But, I mean, I do struggle with this framing a little bit.
How so?
Well, I understand the theoretical fix. But telling an 18-year-old with crushing debt that the reality of the situation is entirely on them, it kind of borders on victim blaming. I mean, how do we separate taking personal responsibility from just letting predatory institutions completely off the hook?
Yeah, and that tension you're feeling, that is exactly why this theoretical bill is in the text.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, we aren't advocating for actual policy here. The author is showing you this to prove that if the government actually wanted to fix this insanely complex problem, they could do it with a 5-page bill.
But they don't.
Exactly, they don't. Because the problem isn't meant to be solved. It's actually designed to create political polarization.
Ah, so a wedge issue is more valuable to politicians than a solution.
Spot on. It's not about letting predatory systems off the hook at all. It's about realizing that waiting for those systems to rescue you is just completely futile.
Yeah.
You're literally going to drown while they argue about who should throw the life preserver.
Man, that's grim. But look, if systemic rescues are just political illusions, we are basically forced to ask a really uncomfortable question.
Which is?
Who is actually coming to save us?
Right.
And the answer to that requires a mindset shift that's usually reserved for, like, survival scenarios.
Yeah.
In self-defense classes, there's this principle that's often taught on day one, which is everything is my responsibility.
Yeah, think about it like being a passenger on a small boat.
Yeah.
Suddenly, you know, the hull cracks and water just starts rushing in. Is it fair that the boat is sinking? No. Did you build the boat? No. Should the captain have navigated away from the rocks?
Well, yeah, obviously.
Yes. But in that exact moment, does any of that actually matter?
Not at all.
Exactly. You are the first responder to the water, filling your own shoes. You have to grab a bucket.
That translates so directly to everyday life, doesn't it? I mean, you're stuck with $120,000 in student debt for a degree you can't even use. It's not fair.
Right.
You're making $19 an hour and keep getting passed over for a promotion by external hires. It's not fair.
Yeah.
But the unfairness doesn't change the water in the boat. You are the first responder to your own life.
And the author categorizes people into two groups based on exactly how they process that water in the boat.
Okay, what are the groups?
Group one looks at a problem and they immediately think someone else should solve it.
Ah, they're the ones waiting for the captain.
Exactly. While group two, they see problems as opportunities.
You know, as an economist, I look at consumer behavior the exact same way. Every single dollar we spend is essentially solving a problem.
Oh, that's an interesting way to frame it.
Yeah, like if you have 3 massive productive pecan trees in your backyard, you are never going to buy pecans at the store.
Right, because you don't have a pecan problem anymore.
Exactly. Or when you buy a Netflix subscription, you're basically solving the problem of boredom. A gym membership solves a fitness problem.
Makes sense.
Group two completely recognizes this dynamic. They look at the unfair world and they ask, you know, how can I develop a solution to this problem that creates an opportunity for me?
And that transition, going from complaint to opportunity, it requires you to completely master the concept of incentives.
Which I love.
Yeah.
Let's trace how this opportunity-seeking mindset actually builds wealth over time. There's a classic behavioral economics case study from the text that I really want to look at. Mike and Chad.
Ah, yes, the two guys navigating the home buying market.
Yeah, right. So Mike is young. He has a decent job. And he looks at the surface incentives that are provided by society.
Yep, right.
He follows the marketing that says, you know, inflation makes a house a great appreciating asset.
Mm-hmm.
So Mike goes out and buys at the absolute top of his budget.
Ouch.
Yeah. He locks into a 30-year mortgage.
Yeah.
And to afford those monthly payments, he actually has to reduce his retirement savings. He basically chooses the comfort of a really nice house today at the cost of his long-term net worth.
Right. Now, Chad, who is in the exact same financial situation as Mike, he completely reverse engineers those incentives.
What does he do?
So Chad buys a house 20% below his maximum budget.
Smart.
Yeah. He buys in an affordable area, and he intentionally buys the fixer-upper.
The one everyone else was complaining about online.
Exactly. He does the cosmetic work himself, and then he acts as his own general contractor to hire out the really big jobs. And most importantly, he does all this knowing exactly what that house will rent for in 2 years.
Because Chad is playing a completely different game. He's governed by this golden rule of the wealthy from the text. Never sell an asset unless the money rolls into a better asset.
Yep. So when Chad is finally ready to move, he rents out that first house. He uses the rent to cover the mortgage and build up an emergency fund.
Mm.
Then he buys a second fixer-upper and just repeats the entire process. Eventually, he's using OPM other people's money to build a real estate portfolio.
The divergence in their outcomes is just massive. And it all traces back to one very specific behavioral trait.
Discipline.
Yeah.
And the definition used here is crucial, I think. Discipline is doing what is hard today for an easy tomorrow.
Right. Whereas most people, like Mike, do what is easy today in exchange for a really hard tomorrow.
Exactly. I mean, Mike wasn't willing to live in a house with ugly carpet and renovate it while living there. But Chad was.
Now, if we follow Mike into retirement, we get this fascinating look at advanced wealth systems. And I should explicitly remind you, listening right now, these are concepts used to illustrate how economic systems and incentives function.
Right. This is definitely not direct financial advice for your portfolio.
Exactly. No financial advice here. But the mechanics of it are incredibly revealing. So let's say Mike eventually builds a business, saves aggressively, and enters retirement with a $5 million portfolio.
Most people assume he's just going to slowly sell off his stocks to pay for his lifestyle, right?
Right. Which is where Mike discovers a hidden incentive in the tax code. He realizes there is literally no tax on cash flow from debt.
Wait, why is that?
Because the IRS views a loan as a liability, not income. You don't pay income tax on money you eventually have to pay back.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So instead of selling his assets and getting hammered by capital gains taxes, Mike borrows against his assets at a very conservative 3% loan-to-value ratio.
And what does that do for him?
Well, he cash flows $150,000 a year, completely tax-free, and his $5 million portfolio remains fully invested, continuing to outpace the low interest on the loan.
That is wild. I mean, compare that to the 15 to 20% of people who retire, you know, comfortable-ish, but they do it by slowly selling off their 401ks piece by piece.
Right.
The author actually compares this to a rancher selling off his heifers.
All of the young female cows.
Exactly. The ones that give birth to the next generation. I mean, sure, it works for a while. You have cash in your pocket today. But your herd is in permanent decline.
Because true wealth stacks assets. It doesn't sell them.
Spot on. But, you know, the cost of waiting for institutional reform isn't just financial. The exact same logic applies to our physical bodies.
Oh, absolutely.
Right now, I mean, there is a massive movement of people begging the government to ban artificial food dyes and seed oils. Or they're demanding that public schools bring back intense 1980s-style physical education classes.
Which honestly might be beneficial.
Oh, totally. But the point is, passing federal food regulations could take decades, if it ever happens at all. In the meantime, no one is actually forcing you to eat seed oils. You can literally choose to exercise today.
The text highlights two doctors who basically bypass the institutional lag entirely. Dr. Ken Berry and Dr. Sean Baker.
Right. These guys didn't wait for systemic reform.
No, they were struggling with their own health. So they fixed themselves first using low-carb and carnivore diets. Then, instead of just, you know, petitioning the government to change dietary guidelines, they actively built new organizations.
Which is such a better use of energy.
Yeah. Dr. Berry helped create the American Diabetes Society to offer an alternative to the sugar-heavy advice of traditional institutional associations. And Dr. Baker created Revro to help people reverse chronic disease.
So they basically built the systems they wished existed rather than just arguing with the ones that did.
Exactly. Which naturally leads to a pretty interesting philosophical question.
Hmm.
When we talk about accepting reality as it is, many people immediately think of the Serenity Prayer.
Oh, sure. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change.
Yeah, that one. And I'm glad you brought that up, because on the surface, the Serenity Prayer sounds basically identical to what we are discussing.
Mm-hmm.
So why does our source material argue that it falls short?
Well, because the prayer is just so frequently misinterpreted as passive surrender.
I see.
Yeah, it makes acceptance sound like the final destination. Like, you accept the broken system, you find peace, and you just stop fighting.
Right. You just sit back.
But the framework we are discussing pushes way beyond acceptance. You don't accept the board to find inner peace. You accept the board so you can actually play the game.
Oh, that's powerful.
Yeah. You can't change what should happen, but you can always find a move inside what will happen.
So if you're listening to this on your commute, you know, heading to a job with an impossible boss or just a completely broken corporate structure, how do you operationalize this? We really need practical tools to shift your brain from the fantasy of a fair workplace to the reality of the one you're actually in.
Well, the text introduces the WILL method to force that exact shift. That's W-I-L-L.
Okay, walk us through it.
So the W stands for watch what is happening. You have to strip away all your outrage, completely delete the word should from your vocabulary.
Just observe.
Exactly. If your boss always promotes external hires, stop being angry about it and just observe the pattern objectively. The world always tells you what it values if you just bother to look.
Okay, got it. Next is I. Interpret the incentives. Once you're watching clearly, you've got to figure out who benefits and who pays.
Right.
Maybe your company's HR department actually gets a larger budget when they do external recruitment.
Yeah.
Incentives explain human behavior infinitely better than stated intentions.
100%. Then we have L. Look for the moves. This is where you finally stop arguing with the board. You ask the word, how?
How do I position myself?
Right. How do I position myself inside this unfair reality until better options appear?
And the final L is launch your action, because you have to do what the terrain allows right now.
You can't wait for perfect conditions.
No, you cannot wait for the ideal action you wish you could take in a perfectly fair world. You have to move, because momentum only exists after you actually commit.
Yeah. So if we distill everything we've covered today, it really comes down to a few core truths.
Let's hear them.
Reality does not negotiate. Arguing with it is a massive, massive waste of your finite energy. But replacing your complaints with the word how literally shifts your mind from a state of victimhood to a state of construction.
To help you rewrite your mental code and cement that shift, the author leaves you with a final, really provocative exercise. It's basically a way to actively program your mind for this new reality.
Yes, I love this part. I want you to input these exact three lines of code into your mental computer right now.
Okay, I'm ready.
Line one, computer, keep my attention on the most likely outcome so I can spot the next move quickly.
Good.
Line two, computer, help me see incentives first so I understand the real forces at work.
Okay, the last one.
Line three, computer, when I identify a problem, trigger the question, how do I move forward from here?
Man, those three lines change the entire game. They really do. And as a reminder, you can find more resources to build your own systems and dive deeper into these concepts by visiting jackslaws.com.
Stop yelling at the chessboard, guys. Figure out the incentives, grab a bucket if your boat is sinking, and make your move. And be sure to check out jackslaws.com for more tools to help you navigate the world as it actually is.